Okay, this review is going to cover linkage institutions, including political parties, election and campaigns, and interest groups. So today, a lot of Americans take pride in being an independent voter. That has a lot to do with de-alignment from political parties. I think people see that political parties are lacking vision for our country. So you don't see as many people identifying as a loyal Democrat or a staunch Republican. There are some negative attitudes towards political parties and the role that they're playing in American politics today. So political parties are an important linkage institution. Linkage institutions link citizens to their government. And the United States political system was developed under the concept that there would not be political parties. That's what the Founding Fathers wanted to avoid. However, James Madison in Federalist 10 pointed out that political factions are necessary evils, but they can be controlled by federalism and separation of powers. So parties basically appeared as soon as the new government was created, and that starts with Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, the Federalists with Hamilton, and the Anti-Federalists with Thomas Jefferson. So let's break down the functions of political parties. Connecting citizens to their government, that's why they are one of several linkage institutions. You've got party ideology and good organization can actually increase political efficacy, making people feel like they have a say in their government and that their government listens to them. Another function of political parties is running candidates for political office. Another one is informing the public. They give cues to voters on how you should vote or how they'd like you to vote. And our political parties help organize our government. Parties are coordinating our government policymaking at several different levels, local, state, federal level. And there are several informal relationships between officials in the government. But with parties, policymaking goes a little bit smoother. So why a two-party system? Most of the modern democracies today have a multi-party system. So the United States is a little bit in the minority with its two-party system. In fact, I think that if you look around the world today, there's only about 15 two-party systems. Even though third parties have emerged in the United States, and right now we've got the Tea Party as a viable party, none have really endured once they lose their leaders. We see short bursts like in the 1800s. We'll talk about that more in a moment. But there are really three important reasons for the party system. The first one is a consensus of values. So Americans actually have a very broad consensus. Both parties have core values of liberty, equality, and individualism. Both parties want to use the existing system to change the government. That's what keeps them more in the center parts of those political spectrums. Another reason why we have a two-party system is the historical influence. The nation began with two parties, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And the third reason why is the winner-take-all system. And that's probably the single most important reason for why we have a two-party system, is our pluralist electoral system. So this system is in contrast to those of proportional representation, where you get a percentage of the vote for the party's candidates is always directly applied to the representatives in the legislature. You see that often in multi-party systems. But in American elections, the one who receives the largest number of votes in each voting district is the winner. You don't need to have 50%. You don't need a majority. You only need a plurality, more than your closest competitor. And that encourages the existing parties to become much larger and trying to embrace more voters. Now, the way that the two parties are organized, at least on paper, is very similar. Both political parties have a national committee. They have representatives from the states. They have a national chairman. They have a national convention that meets formally every 4 years to help elect a president. They have congressional campaign committees that help both incumbents and challengers. And they have a pretty broad ideological base because they have to appeal to a large number of voters. Now, in the early years of political parties, We saw the first two parties, I've mentioned them already, Federalists and Anti-Federalists, and their division came with the ratification of the Constitution. Federalists supported it. Anti-Federalists were concerned about individual freedoms not being included. And so, of course, that issue was resolved with the addition of the Bill of Rights, but the parties did not disappear. The Federalists were led by Alexander Hamilton. They supported Hamilton's establishment of the Bank of the United States. And then the Anti-Federalists, led by Thomas Jefferson, actually evolved into the Democratic Republicans. They favored very strong states. They wanted a weaker central government. They opposed the bank and saw that as an enemy of state control and rural interests. So after Hamilton died, John Adams was kind of unpopular as a president, and so then you've got Jefferson emerging as probably the most popular leader at the turn of the 19th century. So as president, he kind of gave up that sense of a weak central government and started to see the value of having a stronger central government. And at this point, the two parties' points of view were probably most similar. It's called the Era of Good Feeling, and that's when James Monroe became president after Jefferson, and the Democratic Republicans emerged as the only party and pretty much held dominance until the mid-1800s, and then they took on a new name, the Democrats. The two-party system reemerged with Andrew Jackson as president. The country was expanding. The states were finding that they had some things in common with states in their region, and a new party emerged, the Whigs, and they were very similar to the old Federalist Party. So Jackson's election in 1828... was pretty much accomplished because of a coalition between the South and the West, and they formed the new Democratic Party. And at this point, all men could virtually vote, so there was a that's why we kind of see that stronghold of rural, anti-bank, small farmers from the South and the West that are the backbone of the Democratic Party. Whigs were left with not only the Federalist interests, but they had some of the rural, wealthy Southerners. And so this was not really a party that had a lot of coherency. But they did like to elect war heroes like Zachary Taylor and William Harrison. Now, as we're getting ready, as pre-Civil War, as we're getting into the Civil War, the Whigs are falling apart, and now you've got a new party emerging. It's the Republican Party. And the Republican Party emerged out of the issue of slavery, and bringing slavery into the new territories. So the first Republican president elected in 1860 is Abraham Lincoln, and he set off his election, once he was in office, basically set off the secession of the southern states, and that was a lot of the supporters of the Democratic Party. The Civil War ended the dominance of the Democrats. This is the new Republican era. We call this a realignment. Voters realigned, and that was made even more pronounced by the regional differences and the different points of view on slavery and state rights. So the Republican era is going to go from 1861 to 1933, and only with the exceptions of two presidents, Grover Cleveland and Woodrow Wilson, all presidents from Abraham Lincoln through Herbert Hoover were Republicans. Republicans dominated the legislature as well. They were champions to the era of the Industrial Revolution. Lots of businessmen dominated politics as well as business, Rockefeller, Carnegie. And the Republican Party came to represent laissez-faire. Laissez-faire, free market, I think you know that term. Leave alone is what it means. The second Democratic era came after the Great Depression in 1929. Hoover was rejected in 1932 in favor of Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt formed the Roosevelt Coalition of Voters, which combined a lot of different groups together. There were workers, immigrants, southern and western farmers, and some of the ideological liberal. And in an effort to get the country out of depression, Roosevelt's Democrats promoted a lot of social welfare. They followed a Keynesian economic policy, government involvement in the economy. And in fact, Roosevelt was so powerful that you know that even the Supreme Court had to try and reel in some of his power when he tried to pack the court and ask Congress to increase the number of justices from 9 to 15. And that plan was eventually withdrawn. Roosevelt was elected for an unprecedented four terms, and then was followed by another Democrat, Harry Truman. And even though Dwight Eisenhower was a Republican, Congress stayed Democratic through the 1950s, and then the Democrats gained the White House in 1960 with Kennedy and then Johnson, until a new era is going to begin with Richard Nixon in 1969. Now, the new era, starting in 1969, is the era of divided government. So now it's not a Republican-dominated government. There was a new balance of power between the Democrats and the Republicans. And what we started to see was a divided government where one party holds the presidency and the other dominates Congress, or at least the Senate, which is considered more powerful, more prestigious. Now, that division can sometimes bring gridlock, which paralyzes decision-making. But it also shows the declining power of political parties, I think, in general. Now, most of the presidencies from 1969 to 1993 were Republican. Jimmy Carter was the exception in 1977. But the Republicans were starting to pay a lot more attention to the use of media, hiring consultants, turning their campaigns into very well-financed and efficient organizations. And a lot of people think that Nixon was very carefully coached, that he campaigned well, they took advantage of the technologies, and probably the biggest thing is they were raising a lot, the Republicans were raising a lot of money. Now, the Democrats recognized that they needed to make some change, and so they formed a McGovern-Fraser Commission that would review the party's structure and delegate some of the selection procedures. The party adopted several guidelines that were going to increase the representation and participation of groups. So the number of superdelegates or governors, members of Congress and other leaders was reduced. And then in 1972, the convention elected George McGovern, who was a liberal, but he lost in a landslide to Richard Nixon. And then Jimmy Carter, who won the presidency in 76, was defeated by Ronald Reagan. And now you've got the Republican Party in power till 1993. Now, during the Reagan presidency, Democrats were starting to adopt some of the Republican strategies. And I think this helped get Bill Clinton into the White House. He was a master of polls and consultants and figuring it out. But right after Clinton, and divided government where the Republicans held both houses while Clinton was presidency. When Bush got elected, he had a friendly Congress until his second term, or the midterm, where it became divided again. Now, the minor parties, they deserve a mention. Minor parties or third parties do play a role. Usually they're dominated by an individual personality. They're organized around a goal or ideology. Some of the names that we've talked about, Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party or the Progressive Party, Ross Perot, he ran independently but then started the Reform Party, and then Ralph Nader ran with the Green Party. But none of them have really dominated or received much of the vote. Now, another concept, in addition to realignment, which we just talked about between the Republican eras and the Democratic eras, is de-alignment. So over the past 50 years, party identification seems to be weakening with American voters. Many prefer to call themselves independents. So we would call that a de-alignment. And if that's actually happening, are parties becoming weaker in our political system? So there were several reforms, back in the olden days in the 1800s when they had party machines. Think of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and how the party machine was controlling the senators. Those kind of went away with the rise of the progressive movement and populist movement. Their growing emphasis on electronic media and professional consultants have changed and perhaps created some of that de-alignment. But they are still, the parties are still very well funded, and they make use of their advisors and all of those sources, and that's one of the reasons why they're still such a strong influence. Okay, I'm breathing, and we're moving right into the next linkage institution, which is election and campaigns, without breaking tape. So sorry you have to listen to this. Campaigns have become much longer, more expensive. There's been lots of demand for campaign finance reform. We know we need campaigns and elections. It's part of our democratic way. But many people believe that the government needs some new regulations. So first, talking about the functions of elections, obviously the most important function is that they allow us to select our leaders, hopefully from a competitive field of candidates. But elections legitimize positions of power in our political system. So our substantive democracy requires free and fair competitive elections. Now, the Constitution has very broad parameters for the election of public officials. It states the election of the members of Congress every 2 years. The Constitution outlines the definition of the Electoral College. By law, Congress sets the date for the national elections, and it's the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. But some of the electoral guidelines and the rules are held by states. So usually candidates today will run with a party label. And some people will just vote straight party ticket within a state. Others can choose where they want to vote in the primaries. We have a winner-take-all feature to American elections. The candidate with the most vote wins. Again, that's called a plurality. Most American elections are single-member districts, which means that in any district, the election determines one representative or official. So, for example, the U.S. Census, taken every 10 years, allots to each state a number of representatives for the U.S. House. All state legislators divide the state into several separate districts, and then each district elects its own single representative. And that, again, kind of favors the two-party system. Now, there's a process to elect leaders. First, there are primaries. Primaries are usually early in the run. For the elective office, and there are three types: closed primaries, open primaries, and blanket primaries. So in a closed primary, you have to declare in advance your party membership. In an open primary, you can decide at the voting booth which party's primary to participate in. And in a blanket, the ballot lists all of the candidates. The state of Iowa is well known for a variation of the primary. They hold a caucus, and under this system, local party members agree on the candidate that they will support. The local caucuses then pass their decisions on to the regional caucuses, who in turn vote on the candidates, pass it on to the state caucus, and that's who makes the final decision. In both primaries and caucuses, the individual party member has a say in who the party selects to run for office. So once the candidates are selected, they campaign against each other in a government election. And again, you have very poor voter turnout in the United States, so sometimes the primary elections only get about a 25% voter turnout, where in presidential elections you get about a 50% voter turnout. So congressional and presidential elections kind of follow the same thing. We know that presidential elections are national, whereas congressional elections are regional. The House of Representatives is actually less competitive than the Senate or the presidency. Incumbent tradition is very, very strong. Fewer people vote in congressional elections every 2 years when there's no presidential election. And a concept called the coattail effect: if the president's approval rating or popularity is high, then the likelihood that his party members will be elected increases. It's called the coattail effect. Congress can communicate more directly with their constituents when they are back home or regionally. And it allows congressmen, because they're not on the national stage, they're more on the local, they can push off a lot of the accountability and say, hey, it's not us. Now, to get to the presidency, there are several steps, four in your notes, if you're reviewing your notebook at all, that we talked about. But the road to the presidency is first deciding to announce, then getting elected through the primaries. Some of the early primaries in the system are called front loading, when they hold primaries very early to see how the candidate will fare. The third step is having a convention. and officially accepting the nomination. And the fourth step is campaigning. And we think about what we've talked about with the role of the media in presidential debates. Think about the debates we watched in 2012, and think about how advertising is being used to promote and mudsling at candidates. Now, there have been two big criticisms in recent years about U.S. campaigns. That's campaign spending and then also local control of the voting process. So the campaign spending is criticized for many reasons. Lots of reforms were passed in 1974 after the Watergate scandal, and there are several important provisions to that. After 1974, they formed the Federal Election Commission to oversee election contributions. Contributions have to be disclosed. No foreign contributions are allowed, and there are contribution limits: $1,000 per candidate, $20,000 to a national party, and $5,000 to a political action committee, a PAC. A corporation can establish a PAC, but it has to register and have at least 50 contributors. PACs are limited to $5,000 per candidate and $15,000 to a national party. And there are federal funds matching for major candidates, but if you use those, then you have to fully disclose everything, so most candidates deny that. Now, there are different types of money that they talk about. John McCain, who helped write the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Act, criticized soft money. And that's money that's not specified for campaigns, but are basically given to the party for party building activities, but that money makes it into campaigns. There has been major reform legislation some of it signed by President Bush in 2002, but the reforms would end up getting stalled in the House. But the new legislation bans soft money, although it did increase individual contributions from $1,000 to $2,000. Big thing is the local control of the voting process and who has the right to vote. And those issues are current issues today, but they also relate to Bush versus Gore, the Supreme Court case that ended up deciding the presidency in 2000. And look that up if you don't remember the case. Review your notes on the critical realigning elections. These basically reflect the party realignments or major issue changes or changes between the groups. And campaigning is certainly becoming an issue today and is still watched very closely today because the role of political parties and the role of money. But whatever the criticism, American elections and campaigns are a linkage institution and a very dynamic and vital link between citizen and government. Now, the last linkage institution that I want to cover is interest groups. And interest groups are groups that put some pressure for change on elected officials and policymakers on all levels of government. James Madison called interest groups factions. They call political party factions also. But today they play an even more important role. So we already mentioned PACs. PACs have joined in with parties and other interest groups to try and influence policymaking. But I know you have some notes on parties versus interest groups and some of the significant differences between parties and interest groups. Let me throw a couple of those out. First of all, parties are vote maximizers and interest groups are policy maximizers. So parties influence government through the electoral process. They run candidates for office. Interest groups and PACs support candidates, but they're not running their own candidates. So parties want to get support for their policies. Interest groups usually have a narrow focus. They support one or a few related policies. So an interest group usually will just focus in on an area where the party probably has a lot of different areas. Then you've got PACs. These are the money-raising arms of interest groups. And even though the Campaign Reform Act of 1974 tried to limit contributions, the number of PACs is increased. And they represent things like corporations, labor unions, professional and trade associations, a lot of PACs out of the business world. Now, this is a huge review concept from very early in the semester, and these are the theories of interest group politics. So hopefully you remember the concepts behind the elitist, pluralist, and hyper-pluralist theory. These are just different points of view about the role of factions and how interest groups work. So in the elitist, you have a few groups that control the political system, but it begs the question of how can a true democracy exist. In pluralist theory, there are lots of interest groups. They have a lot of people voicing their opinions, and one group can't become too powerful because of how many groups are competing. In hyperpluralist, say that the political system's out of control because the government tries to please every interest and it's creating the gridlock. So even though interest groups have been part of American politics since the beginning of our country, their numbers have definitely grown. You should have some examples of interest groups in your arsenal. Sierra Club, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, ARP, the NRA, they've certainly been in the news lately. And there are some really narrow interest groups as well, but very few occupations or industries go without an interest group anytime that they're going into Washington, D.C. So types of membership of interest groups are institutional, but I think more important is to understand how they're kind of divided into three general types: economic interests, consumer, and public interests. So you've got economic groups like labor unions. They're going to fight to protect the union, right to work laws. You've got agricultural groups. They're not as powerful as today as they have been in the past, but they used to be very, very powerful. You've got business groups that represent large corporations like AT&T or General Motors. Professional groups. This is like the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, the National Education Association. Okay. There are also, I just yawned. There are also groups that work for the public interest in a very general way. Public interest groups. This is where Ralph Nader basically got his start. They're an environmental interest groups like Sierra Club and the Audubon Society, and they're interest groups that fight for equality and justice, like the NAACP or the National Organization of Women Now. Now, interest groups will use lobbying, electioneering, litigation, filing an amicus curiae, which means friends of the court. Sometimes they'll file class action lawsuits with litigation. There's appealing to the public. And in class, we evaluated how different groups might use that lobbying. So a lot of the equality and justice interests are going to use litigation. A lot of the professional groups will use lobbying and electioneering. A lot of the environmental groups will appeal to the public. And interest groups pretty much raise all of their money through membership. That's like through their direct mail or direct solicitation. Federal grants, so organizations that, or money that goes into the organizations through some of the interests that they support. Foundation grants, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a good example of that. But what makes an interest group effective is its size, its intensity, and its financial resources. So if a group has a very large membership, it might have a free rider problem. Intensity, if you can take advantage of when an issue is hot, like right now is gun control, and then the financial resources, how easily can you raise money? Interest groups are sometimes criticized for interaction with the government, known as the revolving door, and this is where members of Congress or in the bureaucracy quit their jobs and then take positions as lobbyists or consultants, because then they may have an unfair advantage over government decisions because of who they know. Or a government official might do a favor for a corporation because they think they're going to have a job when they leave government. So it's worth it to ask, are interest groups contributors or distractors from the democratic process? They've certainly had an influence on the American political system, and I don't see that they're going to go away. That was a long, if you made it all the way to the end and even heard me yawn, good for you. Stay tuned for another one.